Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening, and good morning. You are listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We're about a half hour away from Black Book Talk. Today, your host, Patricia Welsh, talks with guest Ezra Greenspan, author of the book William Wells Brown, An American Life. But first, it's Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman speaks with writer William Gibson. Stick around. That's next on KBOO.
Hey, fellow weirdo. This is Rich, host of Radio Lost and Found. Be sure to check out the show on its new time slot. That's every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media scape of found records, tapes, found sound, internet insanity, and more. That's Radio Lost and Found every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hey, weirdo! Come out and play!
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rank in Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with the trumpet and vocals of Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall, Tuesday, November 11th. Tickets and information for Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall available at aladdin-theater.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is science fiction writer William Gibson. While Gibson himself does not believe that science fiction's primary concern is the prediction of the future, he nevertheless is responsible for coining the term cyberspace and for envisioning the world of the internet and the World Wide Web long before it became a reality. Gibson's debut novel, Neuromancer, was the first to win the science fiction Triple Crown, the Hugo Award, the Nebula, and the Philip K. Dick Memorial Award, at a time that many of the technologies we now take for granted were hard to fathom, and yet Gibson led us to try. Gibson more recently has been writing novels in the half-reality of the present day and near past. The Chicago Tribune says of his book Pattern Recognition that no novel has yet to surpass it as a meditation on the attacks of 9/11. His work is central to both the cyberpunk and steampunk movements, and The Guardian in 1999 said Gibson was the most important novelist of the past two decades in terms of influence. He's here today on Between the Covers to talk about his much-anticipated new novel, The Peripheral, one that returns Gibson's imagination to that of the future, both near and far. Welcome to Between the Covers, William Gibson.
Well, thank you.
Tell our listeners what a peripheral is in the book.
Well, a peripheral is an artificial but largely biological human body. And people, peripherals in our world in terms of computing would be your mouse or your keyboard or an extra screen from your computer. It's anything that adds functionality to a computer. In Wilf's world, peripherals are genetically human but not, in other ways, essentially non-human extra bodies that people can inhabit and operate and experience the sensoria of from any from any distance. So if you live in Portland and you can afford to keep a peripheral in Paris, whenever you want to be in Paris, you just jack in and you're in Paris in your other body doing anything that you could do in your own body, except apparently have a sense of smell. Huh. I don't know why, but that came in. Unless you're willing to pay a lot extra for the thing to have, for your peripheral body to have a sense of smell. I think the idea emerged from wondering idly what the absolute end point of drone technology would be. And I think it would be a drone body. And when the peripherals in the book, the peripheral bodies in the book, aren't being used, they're controlled by their manufacturer's cloud AI, which just makes them behave like courteous, quiet human beings. And you wouldn't realize initially that, you probably would never realize that what you're talking to is an artificial body controlled by this company's cloud AI, because it's very pleasant and it can carry on a conversation, but there's nobody there. It has no self. And if the cloud AI is turned off, it just sits. And people sometimes leave them under dust covers.
Our protagonist in the near future, rural South Flynn, the drama starts in the peripheral when she takes over for her brother, who thinks he's being hired to beta test a game. And she sits in and in playing this game, witnesses what may be a murder, which she is led to believe could be a real murder, and that this may not be a game at all. And that tension that happens there when you mentioned drones, it reminds me a little bit about that dissonance around ethical responsibility, the video game quality of drones. And in this case, the potential assassination may not even be happening from a government. Like today we think of it mainly from governments, but in the future it may be quite a private individual using a drone.
And Flynn's brother and his posse of young veterans are all like mad for drones, and they have dozens of them because they worked with them in the war. And they just they have them the way somebody that they might have a shotgun.
Huh. I don't know if you've been following Gamergate recently, the controversy around women in the gaming world who've spoken up about sexism and have been threatened with violence. But there was a certain satisfaction in light of Gamergate to have a female protagonist in the game world, and it almost felt like a feminist critique of some of the violence that one sees in gaming. And I wondered if that was a conscious thing, or if perhaps I'm bringing that into it.
It very much predated. Like the book was turned in its final form in mid-July. And at that point, I knew nothing. I knew nothing of Gamergate, but I have a daughter in her early 30s who's a native gamer. She grew up with the games, and what I really know of games is through her, and watching her play them. So I'm extrapolating in this book, I'm extrapolating from that parenting experience, and just from what I've been able to. She also professionally works in the games industry and in game development. So I have a little bit of contact a little bit of contact with that. The thing, the idea that I found that most interested me in the peripheral is that Flynn plays the very violent games that she played when she still played games for a living. And it's one of the ways that in this book that a disenfranchised American underclass can put dinner on the table. They work for richer gamers who assemble armies of really good, of skilled players and bet large sums of money on the outcome. But the people who are fighting and dying in the games are doing it to feed their children. And that resonated for me as a, you know, let's not go there sort of thing. I could see, you know, it's one of those things that I could sort of see happening. I hope it doesn't come to that.
Well, I'm surprised that I see some reviewers saying the peripheral is optimistic. I think there's a space of hope, and I think it's cautionary, but it doesn't feel like this sort of late stage capitalist collapse is really necessarily an optimistic vision.
I think that the end of the book, I wasn't planning it this way, but having finished it, and I was sitting around with it, trying to figure out what it was I had done. It seemed to me that the end of the book is a sort of litmus paper for the reader's socio-political sophistication. And if you want to think that's a happy ending or an optimistic ending, well, more power to you. But if I found it gratifyingly ambivalent when it finally, for as the author, I was like really relieved at the, it seemed to me, genuinely creepy level of ambiguity, which is pretty clearly underlined. I mean, one of the book's major characters, very major characters, and the character in the book who knows the most about what's really happening in the world, her last lines in the book are human, all too human. Mm. And that was quite conscious on my part.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to William Gibson about his latest novel, The Peripheral. Well, I know that you push back against people who consider a lot of your work dystopian, saying that you could certainly imagine worse worlds than the ones that you paint, but at the same time, it would be a stretch, I think, as you said, to call them optimistic or bright futures.
Well, I thought when I was writing, I didn't really think about this until I began to write my first novel. I don't think I thought about it when I was doing my journeyman short stories. But when I began to write Neuromancer, I had to make a lot of decisions very quickly. The book was actually commissioned, which is weird. Otherwise, I don't think I would have ever tried to write a novel at that point. One of the things I decided was that I didn't have it in me to do space opera. Like, I didn't feel it. I didn't want to do post-apocalyptic wasteland, which is sort of the traditional thing for a young man to do, because a young man doesn't know much about anything, and he can always do an apocalyptic wasteland. And the world, at that time in the world. The Cold War was still going on in the United States and the USSR. Were poised every passing second with their fingers on the button that could destroy the entire world forever. It actually sounds insane now to say that, but that was literally the case. And we now know, in retrospect, historically, that on at least two occasions, very specific dates, which weirdly we neither know nor celebrate, you can look the dates up, it nearly happened. It came, you know, some Russian at a keyboard stopped it, saw that the systems were automated, and went, oh, shut that down. The Americans aren't really launching a preemptive strike. Anyway, it seemed to me that when I wrote Neuromancer, that it was an act of optimism because so many intelligent, well-informed adults around me at that time thought that our fate was going to be mutually assured destruction. And in Neuromancer, that hasn't happened. They had a little abortive nuclear war, and the global multinationals said, yeah, you're not doing that again. And they did whatever it is they did that created that world. So it did seem optimistic to me then, and even today, this huge number of the world's population would happily immigrate to the world of Neuromancer and be way better off. Mm-hmm. I'd rather live in Neuromancer than Mogadishu. It's got more potential. Right. I mean, it's actually safer.
You said in an interview once that the lack of novelty growing up in a small town in rural southern United States made you develop this capacity to infer that you could look at an object and imagine a distant place because of an absence of stimulation. Could you talk a little bit about that in relationship to this?
Well, when I began to try to write fiction, I found it far more difficult than I had imagined it would be. In fact, I found it impossible. And that the only thing that I could do from the start with any surety and pleasure was to describe imaginary objects or describe real objects in imaginary conditions. And my earliest published fiction is actually a collage of descriptions of imaginary objects. I found a way to frame it with surrealist elegance, as I thought it thought at the time, and I could just bodge all these imaginary things together. And I still, to some extent, work that way. It became like a standard tool in my toolkit that I could give the reader more of what the reader needs to understand the nature of the world and have the satisfaction, the reader would have the satisfaction of having figured it out for herself. I could do that with manufactured objects wherein are, to me, visible the whole history of our society. Like walking into a junk shop or a flea market for me is an experience akin to walking into a really great museum, because it's all human artifacts and all human history is there in a sense. So I wanted to play by very strict rules of science fiction golf and not make it easy for the reader to figure out what was going on. On a second reading, though, I can pretty much guarantee a close second reading, the reader of the peripheral, the reader will realize that huge parts of it are prefigured, and that the meaning, the situation is actually spelled out in quite a number of ways going in. It's just not possible to get it the first time through. Not that the structure of the book is coherent, because I don't even think in terms of structure, but the texture is sort of fractally coherent, all maybe like 85% fractally coherent. Like, it makes a kind of sense in and of itself that is more evident on a second reading. And it's filled with sort of Easter eggs for people who've already read it once.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to William Gibson about his latest novel, The Peripheral. Well, there's also a certain pleasure in having two futures, looking at one future's relationship to its own past, which is in this book, the other future, the nearer future.
Yeah.
Wilf Netherton, living in the far future London, doesn't seem enamored at all by the world that he's living in, and has this great fascination and nostalgia for the past, which raises the question, is this something universal throughout human? Is this something universally human? I wonder, because it feels like...
I suspect that it is, because something I've noticed in my lifetime as a reader is that every generation avenged, you know, when every generation is finally old enough, they see them come to see themselves as the last truly human generation before the deluge of whatever that weird stuff is that's coming over the hill to crush them. And you can find that the ancient Greeks did it really, really eloquently. Like the ancient Chinese did it. We've always done that. And together with it, there's a sort of concomitant admiration for the authenticity and realness and simplicity of life in the past. And one influence on this, I think, was this book was Deadwood, because the thing I most loved about Deadwood is that it's set in this mythic looking place that we all grow up seeing in movies and on TV, and inhabited by these people who we, for the most part, traditionally have depicted as being like us, but rubes in some way, like technologically unsophisticated, and people who would like freak out if they were exposed to our level of advanced technological complexity, but innocence, you know, and in Deadwood, you see that set, and it's inhabited by the scariest people you've ever seen on television. People, bad guys who could take out any bad guy you've ever seen on television just by thinking about it, because they're really, really smart, and they're out to survive. And I wanted, that fascinated me. I thought that was an incredibly great thing that Deadwood did. And I was also conscious of the way in which in science fiction there's a kind of tradition in science fiction of viewing the inhabitants of the future as effete, somehow weak, decadent creatures. Their brains are too large. Their limbs are spindly. I mean, that's been a cliche of science fiction almost since science fiction began. Huh. And I thought, that's funny. Like, we think it's truly all too human, because we think that the people in the past are hicks and rubes and naive, and that the people in the future are weak and effete. Who's good? Like, who's the crown of creation then?
Right.
If not us. And that's the human nature part.
And you've said before that you suspect that we're like the Victorians in the sense that our own self perception is going to potentially be very different than the way history sees us ultimately.
Yes, although I think that it's not so much the Victorians. I think that we're like everybody. I mean, that same idea will apply ultimately to whoever might be looking at us in the future. They have no more, the people in the future will have no more idea of what the people further in the future will see them as than we do.
Well, you've also talked about how you feel like it's easier to imagine the future, to imagine the way the future might be, than it is to actually imagine the past. I think you've even mentioned it would be harder to imagine a world without audio recordings, for instance, than it would be to imagine an extension of the technologies that we have today.
I still think that's true. Anyone can do the thought experiment of trying to imagine what the world was like prior to recorded sound. And it's an odd thing. Or something else I've been thinking about lately is how all of the literature and all of the films and art prior to the advent of the cell phone are going to seem to depict an entirely alien other world of quite incredible human isolation, in which in a 1940s film, an individual alone on the street is actually alone on the street. And that's going to become incomprehensible to us. And I suspect it already is, to some extent, incomprehensible to most of us, because we're a ask Siri away from speaking to anyone we know anywhere in the world at any time, and we live in a sort of quasi post geographical universe. So the world of an actual Victorian novel, like a Dickens novel, is going to require this fantastic imaginative effort on the part of late 21st century readers.
Wow, that's really interesting to think about, mm-hmm. actually. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to William Gibson, the author of The Peripheral. And you also have said that you wanted a double future in the Peripheral to create provide a sort of parallax.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners what you mean. What is a parallax, and what is the idea of a double future creating one doing for you?
Well, if you have only one eye, you have no depth perception, and that's because you need two eyes some distance apart to create what physics calls parallax. You need to have light sources coming in from two different angles, and then you have depth perception, which is why we have two eyes, or in cases of spiders and whatnot, even more. Even it's why they're very few evolved cyclopean animals.
And are you trying to provide essentially a sense of depth and dimension for us to look at potential future?
Well, I wanted to see what would happen when one, I hope, reasonably well-realized imaginary future looks at another, I hope, reasonably well-realized imaginary future. When they look at each other and when they can see each other, how they look to each other. It wasn't something that I could recall having experienced as a reader. And I myself didn't know what it would be like. So a certain long stretch of the composition of the book was, for me, was erecting a framework that would allow that to happen in considerable detail. I suppose if I were a more methodical writer or a completely different kind of human being, I might have tried to write a short story as a sort of architectural model. But I don't think prose works that way. I think prose is sort of more fractal in its nature, and I think that the only way you can find out how that works in a novel is to go ahead and write the novel.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
We are talking today to the author William Gibson about his latest book, The Peripheral. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
In addition to being weird, Portland is becoming known in the tech industry as a city that fosters innovation. Many people working in the industry believe that new technology can solve problems, including social and environmental problems. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Disruptive Technologies and Human Design, Part 4 of Startup City, How the New Tech Boom is Changing.